And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Sarah. This is not her real name, but we are using this name for reasons that will become obvious. Sarah, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks for having me, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sarah, you are part of a minority group in our society and a group that is often not seen or heard. I hope this is not too painful for you, but I'm hoping you can paint a picture for us of your personal experience of being a transgender person. How old were you when you first became sure that you were different?
Oh, well, we've sort of got to go right back there. I would say it was around the age of 4 or 5. And you sort of need to qualify that a little bit in that as a 4-year-old, you understand things from a 4-year-old's perspective, although most adults seem to only think of things from an adult perspective. And so while I knew there was something different at that age, it was really in about the age of 10 or 11 that I realised I am female, but the world will certainly not view me as female, and that caused a lot of issues for a long time in life until I actually did something about it at around the age of 30.
So what were these differences that you noticed?
As a child, it was a really strange thing. There was one time where I was across the park and I had no shoes on. My sister lent me her red boots and I instantly thought I was Wonder Woman. But it wasn't so much about clothing or anything as a child. It was just that you notice around the age of 4, most kids start to realise what their gender is. And I would see my sister or other girls doing things that they were allowed to do, whereas I wasn't allowed to do that. And probably one of the biggest things that I had was we had this line painted on the asphalt at school. And one side was blue, one side was pink, and during playtime, boys had to be on one side, girls had to be on the other side. And I used to just look at that line and I just wanted to cross it. But even though it was just a line painted on the tarmac, it was a physical barrier stopping me from crossing over to the other side. So that's sort of the kind of things. It's when you look at things in hindsight, they all add up. But when you're looking at them in isolation at the time, they don't really add up. But over time, things do.
Yeah, so it started off, it was fairly subtle, wasn't it? Just those little things that probably a lot of people would feel that experience without necessarily coming to the conclusion that they were transgender.
Yeah, I mean, look, probably a very easy way to do it is any person out there, just look at the symbol on a toilet door and try to make yourself go through the wrong door. Mm. So if you identify as male, try going through that female door, probably not good to do it in a public place. You might get arrested, but even just look at that and try to tell your body, this is the door for me, and then flip that around. And that's how I went through my entire life. Everything you looked at, even though the perspective you looked at it was correct to you, the world view and society's view was, no, you are wrong and you must conform to what we're told you to do. And I mean, this was going back to the late 70s and early 80s, so times have changed a little bit now, but certainly then that was the narrative that was pushed in society.
So when you came to a firm conclusion that you were transgender, what did you do about it? What were your first steps?
The first steps was a lot of fear, and really this is the days before the internet, so there was no information out there. To try and get any kind of book on the subject or even to even realise what the word transgender meant, it was hard to find information. So you might go to a library and find, there's a book on the subject, but it was always out or it was lost or stolen, or on the odd chance that you did find a book, not all of it added up because there was still this very derogatory view towards gender. And the world, particularly in Western culture, is a very masculine society, so anything that's more of a feminine look in the world is downlooked, and that's just in general. So to go from what's perceived to be a masculine side of society to want to be on the female side of society, that's just deemed as wrong, and it was a laughable situation. So the information that was out there wasn't very helpful at all. It's one of the few things I can say thank you to the internet for actually existing, because that certainly opened up a lot more information available.
Well, at the time, did you think about going and talking to your doctor, for instance?
Yeah, I certainly did. I struggled with this until the age of 18, and leading up to turning 18, I was just like, no, I'm going to do this. This is definitely going to happen. On my 18th birthday, I'm going down to see my doctor, and walking halfway there, I froze, and I just couldn't do it. To actually want to admit to being myself was an impossible thing to do. And that's just not me. That's most trans people are in that situation.
But did you eventually overcome that and then talk to your doctor?
I did. It took a long time before that happened. I actually went off and got married and had kids before it even happened. But when I eventually did speak to my doctor, he said, I'm so glad you didn't come to me at that time, because I would have had no idea of what to do, and I still have no idea of what to do.
That's not very encouraging, is it?
No, not at all.
And speaking of encouragement, I guess at some stage you had to tell your parents and your sister and people in your immediate family.
Yeah, well, I had initially told my parents at the age of 6 that I was a girl, and they made it very clear to me that wasn't the case and could never be the case. And so when I eventually did come out, it didn't go down very well at all. That started the alienation from my family. It was yelling and screaming matches for a short period of time, and then it was just no contact at all, and that's remained the case ever since. My father did try to get in contact with me a bit, but the amount of conditions that were placed on having any kind of relationship with him, it was just unworkable for anyone to be in that situation, and it was better to not have contact with him, although he is the only family member who has tried to make contact. So, you just get on with life, unfortunately.
Yes, well, your first response, I suppose, was to, with encouragement from your immediate family, was to tell yourself that it's not true. And as you said, you went off and got married and had two kids. But I guess in all that time, was there something boiling underneath that you could feel, or did it all, was it really truly repressed, do you think?
Repression is a fantastic thing. You can tell yourself something for an entire life and you'll end up believing yourself. And that was the case of this. It was a case of, I'll never be able to do this. My body shape is wrong. My voice is too deep. I'm too tall. My hair's the wrong colour. My nose is the wrong shape. It's amazing what you can put up as a roadblock for yourself. And so I put all these roadblocks in place. I also, on the day of my wedding, as my bride-to-be was walking down the aisle, I was like, that dress will look better on me, but I've made this decision. I have to stick with this. This is my lot in life. This is what I have to accept, like it or not, and go through with it. And I made that decision that as long as I'm married, I will stay male. I'll do everything that I have been, for want of a better word, programmed to do in my life, that this is what I have to do. And then the marriage ended.
Did you sometimes perhaps overemphasize that? Like I've heard, some people will sort of grow beards and try to be macho when they're not really that way, but it's just all part of putting up this front.
I was never really macho, and I could never actually grow a beard, which is quite funny. I tried once this is in my mid-20s, to grow facial hair, and after 6 weeks I had a little bit of chin fluff and a little bit of the corner mustache that you see on the average 14 or 15 year old boy that's out there, and this was me in my mid-20s. So yeah, facial hair was never my thing. I could never go ultra male. I was just your stereotypical suburban dad, because that was the role I had learnt to play, mainly to protect myself, that I didn't want to be outwardly feminine in any way in case someone. And this is crazy when you think about it now, but I had this thing that someday someone would be able to walk down the street and spot me as though they had some kind of sixth sense, and then all my life would collapse. It was just one of those roadblocks that you build up for yourself. So I didn't display femininity at all. It just wasn't allowed in society and not allowed within myself because I trained myself to not be me.
And do you think it had any effect on the way you interacted with your children?
Well, my children was a bit of a strange situation. Everyone always said that I was more maternal to my children than their mother was. And certainly in terms of raising the kids, I had a very heavy amount of involvement with them, despite working, and I was working very odd hours at the time, the job that I was in. Even if I'd gotten home at 4 a.m. from work, I would still be the one getting up when the kids got up, getting them ready for school and heading off and spending as much time with my kids as I possibly could and being as involved as I possibly could. And I had friends of mine who were like, I wish I could have this same level of interaction with my children, and that because you dad the right way. You're involved in your kids' life. It's fantastic. And so then it all just stopped, which was quite tragic and quite frustrating, I'd have to say.
Yes, the that would have made it even harder if it could be harder. But you mentioned you then came to that crisis of a divorce, which is perhaps more familiar to a lot of us. You had that terrible experience of arriving home and finding that your wife had taken off. There was an empty house, no kids. But at that stage, you hadn't come out. You were still, as far as all appearances were concerned, you were just the husband, and you came home to this disaster.
That's right. The divorce was a complete shock. Now, looking at it in hindsight, the marriage was going through a bit of a rough patch, as many marriages do. But it was nothing more than a rough patch. There was no yelling and screaming and fighting or anything like that. It was just a bit of a lull. And so coming home and finding an empty house was quite shocking. And my first concern was, are my children okay? Mm. And that, what's happened to them? I couldn't get in contact with Meg. She wasn't answering her phone. I went around to all her family's homes and there was no one there, nothing going on. It was just like, what's happened to my children? And that was quite shocking. And it sort of took a couple of weeks for things to settle down. And the only kind of reasoning I could get out of my now ex for the divorce was, I'm not happy. I've had enough. This is it. I never want to speak to you again. We're over. And probably the crazy thing out of that is that I tried reasoning with her for probably a couple of months and nothing happened, so I filed divorce papers and she says to me, what do you think you're doing? What are you doing this for? This is ridiculous. You can't do this to me. It was a mind-boggling situation. I kind of look back at it now and laugh a little at it, but it's all I can do because it was just so farcical what was going on.
And her family was behind her. I suppose you'd expect that, but I think her mother actually was encouraging the daughter to think she could do better after a divorce than in a marriage.
Yeah, my ex came from a broken home herself, and the narrative that her mother had pushed, even when we were married, was that you are better off being divorced because you can make more money out of it. And so, given the situation the marriage was in at the time, where my work situation had changed and there wasn't as much money coming in, I can sort of look at that as one of the reasons that the divorce probably happened, in that she decided that she was going to make more money out of being divorced. And it was actually an interesting thing that I found out much later in the piece, well and truly after the divorce had happened, that she'd actually applied for child support 6 months before we'd even broken up, and had provided false address details and everything for me, giving her mother's address as my address. And this was 6 months before we'd broken up, so it wasn't there was one thing that caused it. It was planned out a long time in advance that this was going to happen, all unbeknownst to me.
And we're speaking today with Sarah about some issues of a fairly big minority group in our society that's rarely acknowledged. So, Sarah, you probably had faith at that stage that there would be justice in all our major institutions, like the family court, but that wasn't to be, was it?
No, not in the slightest. The family court is a very difficult thing, and I kind of want to temper myself and not just be out and out against them, but there really is no other way. But I could certainly rant for hours if I was to continually talk about them. But I suppose the experience that I had talking in general in the about the family court was that because I wasn't in contact with my children, my ex had made sure that I wasn't allowed to see them, the courts viewed that as, well, there must be some reason that your children are being kept from you. You're obviously evil, for want of a better, more explanative term. So therefore, well, we'd have to get you tested and make sure that you don't have any contact, and let's drag this through the mud for as long as possible. And then it was about 7 months into that process that I actually came out as transgender, and all of a sudden that was the reason for the divorce, that was the reason why I shouldn't see my children, and there was a lot more roadblocks put up. And probably the most surprising thing that I found from the courts was that they saw my gender as now, well, we don't understand any of this. And I couldn't understand that the court couldn't understand something that, well, if you're a child that's transitioning or looking to go into hormone blockers, it's a family court that decides whether you can get that medical treatment.
Yeah, it's part of their charter, you would think.
Yeah, so you'd think they'd have some understanding of transgender issues, but I was in the courts and they're like, well, we don't know what pronoun to use for you, when I'm standing there in a dress and made up and had mists on everything. And they're just like, well, this is too complicated. We can't work it out. And I just thought, how is it this is a court of Australia that they can't work out something as simple as this? And I'm certainly not the first person to have gone through the courts in this situation. And that was just mind-baffling, that the level of understanding of very basic issues in any regard, not just transgender issues, a complete and utter blind eye. It's like, how are you people able to wear shoes with laces on them? Because that seems too complicated for you.
Yeah, well, you not only that did they not understand or not want to understand, but they had an image of transgender people that was all wrong, that transgender people were menaces to society, in effect.
Yeah, it was very much that it was viewed that it was a mental illness, which in the old DMSV standards, which is the standards that mental health is done by, in the old versions of it, it was. These days, it's not. And certainly when I was going through the course, it wasn't viewed as much, but that view was still there. And it wasn't helped by my ex putting up massive roadblocks that things like, well, people like me are only involved in prostitution and I would be trying to force the children into prostitution because of this, which is just deplorable how anyone could think that of the other parent of their children, that people like me were just drug users and I'd be trying to get the kids to take drugs and things like this. It was just, and you're like, how can any reasonable person, first of all, come up with such an accusation? And secondly, how can any reasonable person, and certainly a professionally qualified and trained person like the courts, even contemplate that this is reasonable? But they just lapped it up. And it was, I found the situation that my ex could throw up anything she wanted and the courts would turn to me and say, we want you to prove that this isn't the case. And you can't prove a double negative.
Yeah, you're chasing rabbits down holes. Yeah, we know that feeling. But despite all that, you were successful in that you were able to get a 50-50 custody order, but at the end of the day, that didn't really help you, did it?
Yeah, it was quite surprising. After battling in courts for nigh on 6 years, and I actually had over a dozen court orders all saying different levels of custody and care, and the final judge said that to my ex's lawyers, and she was being represented by legal aid, and they'd thrown every resource at her. So there was senior counsel, solicitors, there was senior counsel for children as a supposedly independent lawyer. And so I was up against a bevy of six legal professionals while representing myself, and the judge turned to them and said, there is no way you can win this case. The way you've acted in this case is deplorable. You need to look to Sarah as to how to actually run a legal case. You have no standing whatsoever. so come to an agreement. And the agreement was 50-50 and didn't matter. Haven't seen the kids.
Before we leave this, I also wanted to ask you about the court's evil twin, the Child Support Agency. The agency officers take a lot of time off to do courses on how to deal with parents, but did you find the Child Support Agency officers helpful?
I've sort of got to take a step back from the CSA to begin with and explain a term that people may have heard of called a TERF. That's T-E-R-F, which is a trans-exclusionary radical feminist. Now, these are people who believe that trans women shouldn't be seen as women and that we're just men invading a women's space to deconstruct it. The funny thing is that, particularly for trans women, many of the issues that we face are the same as issues that women in general face. And so feminism and trans activism certainly work side by side, or at least should, but there are people who choose that shouldn't happen. And dealing with the CSA, I certainly experience a lot of TERFs, direct derogatory comments, refusal to use my legal name, insisting that I use the old dead name that I had, causing police raids in my house simply because I'd say to them that what you're saying is contradictory to what I was told previously. I need the correct information, and apparently that was seen as a violent gesture towards the CSA. So the treatment for them was, we will not recognise you as a person, you are nothing more than an ATM, and we will take you for everything we possibly can, and then more. I'd have to say the first night of good sleep I ever got was the night I'd stopped paying child support.
So, where are we today? You're not paying child support, but on the other hand, you haven't seen your children for 15 years. You're excluded from many in your family, and I guess you've lost some friends over the period, but are you about to start a rebuilding?
Well, speaking of friends, if you ever want to see who your actual friends are, transition, because you won't end up with many left, I can assure you that.
You must turn into something of a leper, I guess.
Absolutely. I am at the point now where I can start to rebuild my life. Unfortunately, it's rebuilding my life without my children. I honestly don't think I'll ever see my children again, and I'm not saying that in a woe-is-me way. I just think that they've been poisoned so much against me that it will never happen. Having said that, my door is always open to them. My children are as much victims in this situation as I am, if not more so. And so I have no hatred or ill will towards my children at all. I know that they've been told a lot of false information over the years. I know that the situation that they've been living in is one where anything that's bad is viewed as being caused by me, anything that's good has been caused by their mother, and any child in that situation will unfortunately see that as their only option. But now, yeah, I can finally start to rebuild my life. And I sort of look at now, I'm in my mid to late 40s and I'm sort of starting out at the point that most people are when they're 18. So,
well,
I'm trying to get on with life.
Yes, it can only go up, I hope. So, Sarah, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, I've gone with Kate Miller-Heidke, Just Can't Shake It. Sort of two reasons why I've gone with this song is, one, it's about the most mainstream song I have in my musical collection. I'm a bit eclectic when I go with musical taste. And also thought that the discussion today might be a bit on the heavy side for some people, so let's have a light and bright tune to end things with. And if there's anyone out there, I've got to say, that is experiencing any issues or concerns about their gender, there's some wonderful resources out there, and it is worth exploring. In Australia, there's known to be about 250,000 people on the gender spectrum. Just because you're on the spectrum doesn't mean you have to go through a beset transition or anything like that. But if you are struggling with it, particularly internally, there is help out there and there's some great resources.
and that was Can't Shake It by Kate Miller-Heidke. And we're speaking today with Sarah. We need to change society's attitudes towards gender diversity. And some of the things you're thinking about are that first of all, people should stop fearing people who are transgender, and perhaps realizing that if they accept that it's not a lifestyle choice, it's not something you chose, it's just it's who you are. That would be a big step, wouldn't it?
Look, absolutely. It can be a very basic level that can be done at, in that people just need to accept what someone's gender is. And it's not something that we actually actively choose. No one in society does that. But there are those of us who have a medical condition and need medical help to overcome that condition and then get on with life. We're not asking for something big, just recognition of name, recognition of gender, which I think is intrinsic to anyone in society. I mean, certainly, Bill, if you went home and started calling your wife or your partner by male pronouns instead of female and decided that you're going to start calling her Harry, I'm sure she'd get upset about it. And that's a very basic thing that I think is fine to anyone in life to just accept, have society accept that they are who they identify as. And that would be a big step, but unfortunately in society that doesn't happen. And sexuality and gender are two very separate things.
Look, it's an important topic, and we are very grateful to our special guest today, Sarah, for being so open with us and from her own experience, and also just doing what we can to perhaps change society's views in the way it's certainly changed with homosexuals as another part of our community. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. And if you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now. Sarah, thank you very much for being on the program. It's been wonderful talking to you, and we really appreciate that you've taken the time to talk to us.
You're welcome, Bill. It's been a pleasure. And to any parent out there that's going through parental alienation, I have your back. I know it's tough, and I hope one day you do get to see your kids again.
That's it for this week, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.